Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Interview was fascinating. It's with Jed and Todd Wider, the directors of the new film God Knows Where I Am. As soon as it's available, you need to get out there and see this film. It's a brilliant piece. It's a gorgeous film. It's provocative. It's engaging. It's compelling on so many levels, and it's really about so many different things. It also stars Laurie Singer, who is the voice of Linda Bishop, the woman that this film sort of really, I suppose, focuses on. And so we have this wonderful chat about mental health issues. We talk about others. We talk about reaching out. We talk about being, you know, this notion of anti-establishment. And I guess really what freedom really actually means. And we talk about, you know, this idea of giving people a face and giving people a voice in a community. It's about, I guess, just being able to listen to others. The film is God Knows Where I Am. It's about, too, you know, just these sort of, we talk about the idea of being porous cracks in our social safety nets. And so some of the things that come up, it's a brilliant film. You got to see it. Jed and Todd Wider, the directors of God Knows Where I Am, Laurie Singer, davidpecklive.com for more podcasts. You can find out more about my public speaking and also about my book, Real Change is Incremental. You're going to enjoy this interview. It was fascinating for me, and I'm looking forward to part two, God Knows Where I Am. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are here once again at Hot Docs celebrating a world premiere of the film God Knows Where I Am. And I'm, can I say blessed to be sitting here with the filmmakers and maybe the star of the film? Please, why don't you guys introduce yourselves in just 32 and a half seconds about who you are and why you're here.
Sure. So I'm Jed Wider. I directed this film together with my brother Todd. It's a film that we've been working on for over 4 years. We've produced just about 17, 18 documentary films over the last 18 years. This is our directorial debut.
I'm Todd Wider. I'm Jed's brother. And I agree with what Jed just said.
What he said.
And then we also have Laurie Singer, who lends her wonderful voice and performance to the readings of the Linda Bishop diaries in the film.
So I'm wondering if you guys can give us a little bit of a quick overview about what this film is in your own words about. I mean, for me, it was about a whole lot of things. I mean, of course, it's about mental health issues, but it goes so much deeper than that, it seems to me. We're talking about issues of humanity and freedom and recollection and friendship and family and regret, I suppose, and the real practical side of things as well, the medical side to some of these issues. But for you guys, I mean, you know, maybe what drew you to it, and then, you know, what kind of, what you were exploring as it was unfolding.
Well, I think at this point in our sort of social development as a society, we for some reason seem to frequently walk over people that are homeless and severely mentally ill that are all around us. These people we see every day, certainly in our city, in New York City where we live, The city is filled with thousands and thousands of homeless people that are severely mentally ill. And this is a city of tremendous wealth, yet we often seem to ignore these people. And each one of those people is a human being that has integrity, that had a family, that had a mother and a father, that may have had children or a loved one, you know, or a wife or a husband, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, had experiences just like we had. They at one point ate dinner with their family and, you know, had a house probably at some point, had shelter, and certainly had a situation better than the situation that they have found themselves in. And it seems to me that if we assume that, you know, and we hope, I guess, that a society should be heading in the direction of uplifting humanity as opposed to pushing it downwards and celebrating humanism, you would think that we would try to lend out a hand to those people. And, you know, some would argue, well, anyone has the right to sleep on a park bench if they so choose. Perhaps they have the right to do so, but is that okay? Should a society say that's okay that a person sleeps on a park bench? And we would argue fairly strongly that it's not okay. It seems to me there should be, you know, ample and adequate facilities everywhere to house homeless people, to feed them, to clothe them, to give them medication and treatment, and to treat them with dignity, which is what they should be treated with, as opposed to being ignored. So we chose to look at this film and examine the case of one person, who Linda Bishop, who was loved, had a daughter, had a sister, had friends, had family, was laughing in life, you know, liked to cook, was a visual person, was an art history major, saw the world visually, embraced, you know, interpersonal relationships, was interested in astrology, had myriad of interests, went to university. And yet, due to her mental illness, somehow managed to slip through the ever-porous cracks in the social safety net and fall so deeply down that she wound up dying alone, starving to death in an abandoned farmhouse in New Hampshire, hiding under a blanket on the floor, literally starving to death. So, and all she had to do before this was simply open the door of that building, walk across the street, and she would have been saved. So why is it that she wound up in that situation? What were the circumstances that led to that situation, both in within her head and also within the society that we live in? And that was the reason why we did this. We wanted to give a face, we wanted to give a voice to this person to bring back her dignity in an attempt to blow the issue out and make people feel empathy, feel something for this person, and then we would hope leave the theater thinking, you know what, this person I'm walking by while I'm leaving the theater, this is another Linda Bishop. We need to do something about this.
There's a sense in which this is about Linda, but it seems to me this is really kind of a comment on the community as a whole, right? I mean, this isn't, you know, the fact that she could look out the window and see the cars going by. I think one of the medical examiner or the police officer says he could watch from the window of that. The living room could watch the TV in another house. I mean,
yes.
How can you be so alone and suffering through your own brokenness in such a profound way and yet be on the edge of assistance and help and so on, right? And
well, the other
ever porous
yes.
social safety net.
And I think what's also interesting is that every person we spoke to in the film was deeply from the policeman that first encountered a body to the passerby who saw the body in the house, to the medical examiner that examined the body on the site, to the neighbors that lived around her, the building, to the people that owned the building, to her sister, to her daughter, to her friends from the past, every single one of those people was engaged and would have been engaged in an act to help and save her. All the neighbors that lived around that building came to us while we were filming the film and said, my God, if I had only known, I would have called the police, I would have taken her in, I would have given her food, of course I would have helped. The policeman, his biggest regret is that he couldn't have gotten there to save her. He was racked by that. He said, if only I could have been here, I would have saved her, I would have done something.
Doesn't her sister even say that she was driving by?
Yes, her sister went back and forth going to work 50 times or more, literally drove in front of the building without ever knowing she was there. You know, and the reasons that she got into that situation are multifold and complex, but they're very problematic. You know, our privacy laws in the United States are deeply problematic. The way that she was discharged was deeply problematic, with no social service thing set up whatsoever. The privacy laws are such that her sister and her daughter weren't unable to find out that she was even in the hospital. So if they called and said, I want to speak to my mother or my sister, the hospital would say, well, we cannot confirm or deny that she's here. So when she was discharged, no one knew that she was being discharged. So there was no plan for her to go. She was basically discharged back to homelessness, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but I brought the point up before that all these other people, and I think like us, like most people in our society, individually we think, my God, this is not acceptable. I would never have allowed this to happen to this woman. If I had had a situation, I would try to give this person food. I would try to give them shelter. I would do something. I would call the police. I would do something to help. Yet, for some reason, we cannot seem to unify into some sort of cohesive force to fix these problems. Mm. Why is that? Mm. If you have individual desire, person by person, that this is not an acceptable situation, I am not okay with this. You know, randomly interview 100 people, the vast majority will say, this is not acceptable that homeless people wander around my city. Yet we can't seem to cohesively come together and find a solution to this problem.
So to what degree does her her independence play into that? I mean, that really comes out in the film, right? Even with the archival footage, some of the poetic recollections, the diary, some of her statements, even her family said, oh, she was profoundly independent. I don't know if the word fierce is used, but you get this sense, this is a strong voice here saying, this is the way things are, and I don't want people interfering. So get the hell out of my life, right?
She was a fiercely independent woman. I mean, she had... she had grown up, she had gone to college, she had a daughter, she had a sister who worked for the court system in New Hampshire. She was very intelligent, she was very artistic, but she also had deep convictions also. And in many ways, and her friend speaks to this, who was in the film, Kathy, speaks to the deep convictions that she had, that she was really very much anti-establishment oriented. Growing up, she didn't want to be told what to do. She always did her own thing. We have, you know, interesting 8mm footage of her as a young girl at a birthday party, sort of dancing her own way. You know, while all the other little girls at the party are dancing in a particular way, she's doing her own sort of unique artistic dance. And she didn't want to be institutionalized. She didn't want to be told to take medication. She didn't want to be told what to do. And you know, she—that's who she was, and I think for Linda, her own sort of sense of independence, eventually, as she was arrested, as she found her way into the judicial system, intersected in a manner which was not, you know, unfortunately, created great conflict for her. Mm. And the fact that she was forced to be institutionalized for up to 2 years, the fact that they were attempting to medicate her, for her created obviously great conflict, because when she's finally released unconditionally by the hospital, she wanders down a path. She finds her way into a place called Hoboville, where many homeless lived. And eventually, she finds her way to an abandoned historic farmhouse in New Hampshire. And for that farmhouse for her, in many ways, represented freedom. Mm-hmm. And she uses that word throughout the journal. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, this is my fifth day of freedom.
Yes.
You know, I'm here. I'm not told what to do.
Isn't there a line where she says, I'm only going to go out in the day or at a certain time because I don't want to be seen?
Yes. Yes. And she, you know, she did not want to be seen.
Yeah.
You know, she lived in that farmhouse during the day, when others would not find her for the most part. And she would go out at night and she would take walks at night. She would collect apples at night from the local apple orchard, behind the house. She would collect water. At one point, she even says that, you know, my positioning here inside the house is much like many people, you know, had to do during World War II, hiding from the Nazis. And she considered herself, you know, as a result of that. I mean, she really considered herself to be hiding from others, and she didn't want to be found, and she went to great lengths not to be found. In fact, when the homeowners come to finally inspect the house after a period of time, and they drive an hour and a half to come inspect the house, which is basically abandoned, although they own it, and the house is for sale at that point, She hides, you know, within the upper attic of the house, the rafters of the house, not wanting to be found. She cleaned up the house to make sure that, you know, no one would realize perhaps that, you know, that someone was there. Mm-hmm. She even remarks that it was a close call.
Yes.
You know, someone came to, you know, someone came to the house. For Linda, this conflict ultimately, you know, conflicts obviously with her mental state. Mm-hmm. And
what do you do, Jed, with that deep irony that she really does want connection, it seems to me? I mean, I was in tears a couple of times. Congratulations, by the way, on gorgeous, beautiful, compelling film. And that's a question I need to ask. Why make such a beautiful film about such a tragic story? And there's something, you know what I mean? There's something really, though, profound, I think, about that metaphorically. But there's also that paradox of hiding in the attic from people who could have kind of helped and saved her. Not could have, but could probably would have. And that's kind of where she winds up in a way.
I think that she, it's interesting because it raises a number of issues. It raises an issue of, you know, under what circumstances does a person have free will to make that decision that they, in fact, you know, want to be there. We would strongly argue that, you really do not have free will if your mind is not free. And, you know, when, even though Linda, you know, was fiercely independent, she was full of life. And she had a full life prior to arriving at that farmhouse. She had family members who loved her. She had friends who loved her. She, you know, was deeply passionate about food. She was deeply passionate about nature.
Oh, just passionate about life.
About life in general, literature. Yes.
You know, the poetry of this woman's life.
Yes.
And the way everybody talks about her, there really wasn't any, other than her daughter, who's clearly makes the distinction near the end of the film that there was my mom and there was this other person.
Yes.
There's this profound sense of community, of love, of friendship.
Yes.
Right?
Well, this is the ravage. This shows the ravages of severe mental illness that is not treated, right? Mm. I mean, she had some treatment, some medication, and following this sort of tradition, standard, very typical trajectory of a person that goes off the medication, often people feel comfortable if they're medicated, and then they say, well, now I'm better, I'm not going to take my medication. In her case, it was particularly tragic because she was medicated, she was doing better, and her father got quite ill, and she needed to go to Florida to take care of him, and she felt that, as many of these medications do, she would be too sleepy, and if he called out for her at night, she would be unable to answer him. So she decided strategically to go off the medication, which was a tragic mistake.
And also in a real irony, too, right? Out of trying to help
out of love and concern for her father, she went off the medication. And that one decision began this sort of domino effect that led to this path.
Sure.
That led her down that path. And, the film shows, I think, the path that many people wind up going down, and the ravages sort of what happens when you're severely mentally ill, when you have intermittent moments of coherence and incoherence.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Psychiatrists that have seen the film have remarked that it's sort of an amazingly insightful study of mental illness, of bipolar. In her case, she had probably bipolar with, paranoid ideation and psychosis, and it's a very clear view of what happens. You're not completely psychotic all the time, and you're certainly not coherent all the time. So she was intermittently psychotic and delusional, and intermittently coherent. And she was coherent enough to make an observation about a bluebird flying around outside the window and how beautiful it was and remark on it, but she was not coherent enough to open the door and go across the street and get help.
And get help, No, the paradox that runs throughout is just profound to me.
And the other thing I might add is there is a warping of insight into one's own personal safety and well-being that gets warped. You know, thinking that, and you could see in the film that warpage, it gets much greater warped as the film progresses, that warping happens, that it's more profound.
I want to talk about Steve and her longing there, because for me this film's about longing, it's about memory, it's obviously about mental health and so on, but it's just, there's a spirit of inclusion versus exclusion, and depending on, I suppose, the emotional baggage you bring to the film, maybe you come and you say, wow, this is all about exclusion because she hid herself in this farmhouse, but really the farmhouse is freedom, so it's really quite the turn the whole conversation on its head. But Laurie, can I ask you about the poetry of her diary, of the beauty of the language, and the way you you know, you present it. I mean, I was, I don't know, can I say I was there with you in the farmhouse? Is
thank
that
you.
Fair?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I felt that Linda has had a tremendous sensitivity, and when you say she could have just walked outside, she could have just waved from the window, mm-hmm. and all these people say, "Oh, I would have helped. I would have helped." This is from Linda's perspective, so I don't want to offend anyone, but she doesn't. To be helped is not to be locked up in her mind. That's that kind of to take away that freedom. So she was caught in her mind again. I'm not saying this is, you know, the way I think life should be, or but since I really delved into her actual being the best that I could as a human with my own experiences, I felt that she wanted peace. She wanted love. She wanted people to treat each other better. She went to 9/11, and she didn't have any particular skill. Yeah, she had no particular skills that she could offer, and yet she was there trying to hand out water bottles, trying to hand out blankets, because that's what she had to offer. And I think she felt greatly misunderstood. And when people were unkind to her, she felt it more than maybe they felt, oh, it's okay, we're just going to run here and do this, and it doesn't matter. It mattered to her. Mm-hmm. She's very sensitive. And perhaps her father, when she went to try and help her father, and she went off the medication, and again, that was for her father that she went off the medication, that did begin her descent, because that was holding her somewhat into a reality check, so that she could balance her own perception and her own sensitivities against a real world that needs food, that needs you to work to make money, sure. that has requires quite a bit of every person. And I think that that's the tragedy, is the juxtaposition between her longings and her yearnings and her actual capabilities. And yeah.
Well, and I think for me, aren't we all kind of, don't we all have a little bit of her in us?
Yes, I think. Don't we all want freedom and
we're all
kindness?
For inclusion, yeah. And being affirmed and being welcomed into the, I don't know, the party.
Yeah.
the risk of sounding corny.
Yeah.
But isn't it true? Isn't that real? I mean, even the daughter's voice, you know, her.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think about the passing on of that from tradition to tradition.
Yes.
To tradition. And to what degree are sometimes mental health issues even passed on emotionally?
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Mental, you know, so, yeah, no, so and many questions.
Yeah, and you mentioned Steve. I think he represented so much to her.
Yes.
I think it was and she imbued this.
Well, and the way you the way you deliver it, I'm getting a shiver right now.
Thank you.
I use that phrase a lot in my podcast, but it's true. And it really, I mean, I broke my heart several times listening to the film and watching the film, but listening as well.
Thank you.
And as I said, it brought me into the farmhouse with her.
Thank you.
Yeah, and
I felt her journey.
It looks
so
like
much.
You want to respond to that, Todd. But I do want to ask that question about the technical aspects of the beautiful film with such a tragic story. But
Oh,
this is great.
Well, I felt that this film and what Jed and Todd Wider captured also so amazingly was the beauty of her perceptions. The idea of her reality they painted with such compassion.
With Terrence Malick, by any chance?
He was an inspiration.
There were clear inspirations for us. As you know, filmmakers and film and you know, big film buffs, you know, Terrence Malick's work certainly was an inspiration. You know, particularly Terrence Malick's very sort of beautiful way of attempting to, you know, depict consciousness. You know, he has a beautiful way visually, and also using sound to depict the state of consciousness, you know, which is an interesting human phenomenon.
Sure.
And so he certainly was an influence. There were other influences, but he was definitely one of them.
You know, what we set out really to do in making this film, because she was a very artistic individual. She was an art history major, you know, and she appreciated art, she appreciated beauty, and she, you know, she was able to, verbalize, you know, her interests, her thoughts, her observations in a very poetic manner, We wanted to pay tribute to that element of her. We went about doing that the best way that we know how to do that as filmmakers, which is to show that visually. So for us, we paid and we attempted to pay, you know, acute attention to how we shot the film. And we shot the film with real film. We shot in 35 millimeter. Mm-hmm. We shot in 16 millimeter, super 16 millimeter for very specific reasons in very specific scenes. We wanted the film to have a certain patina to it, a certain feel, in many scenes to evoke a sense of memory, because part of this film is really about memory. It's about a woman, you know, in a house by herself, writing a journal, which is her voice. It's her human voice, and Laurie did a brilliant job of bringing that human voice to life. But we wanted to. At the same time, we also wanted to pay tribute to her. And we did that through the choice of film that we used, 16 and 35 and Super 16, the way that we shot it, the attention to light throughout the film, which is light that she would have seen. We shot the film in the farmhouse. We shot it over a two-year period, over two winters, two falls, two springs. And, you know, the light changes, obviously, during that course of time. And the fact that she sat there, you know, all day long, during darkness, during the course of the day, during, you know, when the sun went down at 4:30 in the afternoon, and she was left in, you know, complete darkness, complete silence. But we also paid particular attention to sound, because sound was an important feature of this film as well. And for us, we tried to create, and we wanted to create, you know, really an experiential type of documentary. We wanted you to feel what it was like for Linda to be there in this house, not only seeing exactly what it was that she saw, the books that she saw, you know, the soiled mattress that she saw, the wallpaper peeling off the wall, what she saw outside the window, life going on, and during the spring and during the fall, vibrant life.
Well, the simplicity and the beauty of it all, too.
Yes.
I mean, you guys capture that so well.
Yeah.
On one level, it's you don't really notice it. But
yes.
On another level, you're nuts not to.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I think that's what you guys are kind of highlighting with the technique, and or at least for me anyway, what I took away from it was there's so much more going on than meets the eye, and we really need to sometimes just shut the hell up and pay a little more attention.
Yes. Yes. And we paced the film in a certain way so that and this played into sort of this notion of creating an experiential documentary. We paced the film in a way that it contributed to the feel of the film. It contributed to you feeling what it was like to be there. So, you know, in one particular scene where Linda mentions that, you know, she was in a house in darkness, you know, we held on that scene for a period of time. So you actually felt that.
I was just going to say, as I listened to Jed saying this, just in terms of filmmaking also, which with some of the best filmmakers that I've been, you know, fortunate to work with, like, you know, Robert Altman and Schlesinger and a few people, amazing people, that this film, what also is interesting is that Jed, as he talks about the amazing scenes that are captured in from Linda's what Linda saw, it's almost as if either one could stand on their own. Just the images. If you sat back and just watched those images, it would be very powerful.
I mean, I'm not a documentary expert, but you don't see it in documentaries.
Right. It's stunning, and it's very meaningful. And the layer of sheerly Linda with nothing. If you just listen to that story, that compelling story, and her humanity being expressed in a very true way. It's also very powerful on its own. And I think the combination of what they did is really astounding. And Jed's mentioning the pace, it really is an experience. The film they made is an experience.
So sadly, because we've got maybe a publicist or two breathing down our neck here, we have to wrap this up in a second. But can we talk really quickly about this idea? And I want to come back to it here, this idea of inclusion and Steve. this somebody who was supposedly an imaginary, there was an imaginary relationship of some kind, somebody that was married, she met at the diner that she worked at, but she, and the way you deliver it, Laurie, is just remarkable. I should be with Steve watching the sunset. I need to be with my husband. Again, I'm getting the shivers. Mm. And I just go, if this woman had had that kind of relational embrace, whatever that means, things would have been different.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. Again, you know, you have a situation where she was in a delusion, right? She was in a delusional state in that house when she was longing for Steve. You know, Steve is essentially a complex delusion that she's having, that she has a husband that is going to come and save her, when in fact Steve was a gentleman that she met briefly in a Chinese restaurant that she waited on with his wife, and they knew each other in passing, and that was it. And there was no affair. There was nothing else. There was nothing. It was all fabricated.
Longing,
yes.
The longing clearly was real.
Well, I think it is human nature, and I think you were alluding to this earlier. It seems to me that it is human nature. Certainly, the healthier part of human nature is to seek interactions with other human beings, to seek meaningful interaction with other humans, be it through love or friendship or what have you. You know, and in fact, when Linda was in that house, her memories are of relationships that she had, you know, as a child, with her sister, whatever.
Right.
And she's longing for an imaginary relationship with a person that she's idolized in her head. But it's still, she's longing for a relationship. Yet, in her ill state, she sought solace alone and isolated in a building, right?
Yeah.
That's the reality of what she was really doing. In her delusional state, she was interacting with people in her head. Mm. But in
the optimism that Steve is going to come and rescue, there's also
I think that's the hope of that. Yeah, and as I said, I think that in the healthy human brain, I think most healthy humans long for and seek out other interactions with other human beings, are plugged into the society of humans that we're in. I think if you are severely mentally ill, often people that are ill tend to isolate. And that makes the situation that they're in worse, and it makes their mental illness worse, you know?
I was going to say also, just because you mentioned that also, you know, in the books, as she's looking at them, she looks at the farmhouse, and she sees Brian as a young boy, and she reads Brian's paper, and she sees he got an F. And she said, well, I think it's, you know, she really appreciates the paper. She thinks that basically she would go to bat, you could see, you know, against the teacher. You know, he did very well. And then out of everybody, as life is, I think there's so many signs. I believe also, Brian is the one that drives up that could have saved her. He was the one that went in the house, went up to the attic, and opened up the little latch and looked to see. I mean, it's just that those little misses in life that we have that are so compelling and touching.
I also think, though, that you know, we can obviously sit here and we can, you know, we can you know, guess whether or not, you know, if this had happened, that, you know, perhaps the outcome could be this, the outcome could be that.
Sure,
but
sure.
You know, the larger societal issues, you know, when we look at her case and we look at what happened to her and how she fell through the cracks of a failing system, and the fact that she didn't have a safety net in place are really profound, you know, and they resonate in many different countries, many different societies around the world. Many countries, societies deal with this issue in a different way. Some deal with it much better than others. Some fail completely. You know, in the United States, it's interesting because you look back to the time of JFK, you know, when his sister was institutionalized against her will, and she was lobotomized as well. Now, that had a profound impact on him, and one of the first acts he went about attempting to pass when he became president was a complete reform of the mental health system, at least in the United States. And unfortunately, it didn't get the funding, the full funding that, you know, that he had asked for. And over the decades, how people were treated really changed, and the landscape changed significantly. You know, his vision was a more community-based sense of healthcare for the severely mentally ill. And when we look at Linda's case in particular, you know, there were many elements. Had they, you know, been handled differently, if decisions had been made, if she hadn't been released unconditionally from the hospital.
It's not any one thing.
If the judge perhaps had been, You know, if the judge perhaps had been better versed, better prepared for handling a mental health patient, perhaps Linda would have been on the stand for another 3 months.
Those words as being really harsh, right? Coming
yes.
from the judge and so on.
Yes.
Now looking back.
Yes. Yes. I think it's a very complex set of issues.
Yeah.
It's very dynamic, and there's not one right answer. There's not one wrong answer. But when you look at it, in the aggregate, clearly we can do better as a society.
Absolutely.
She should have had that safety net.
Yeah.
Her sister, the daughter, were not notified. It sort of begs the question from a privacy perspective, is that right? Should that have been the case?
Yeah.
Do we need to take another look at our privacy laws?
Well, we're just so, and I just want to affirm what you guys have done with this film on so many levels, but we're just starting to have this conversation, really, the mental health conversation, right? It's been around for, as we know, centuries, but it's really only starting to bubble to the surface now.
I think there's one other thing I wanted to add. Yeah, you had asked before why depict such a tragic story with such beauty, and I think, at least for me, I think it is poetry that reminds us of the nature of the human condition. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It is artistry. It is poetry. It is the things that we can aspire to and the greater things that we can do as human beings. And it's that pursuit of beauty and that exploration of beauty that remind us of what it is to be human. So in a way, by using poetry to tell her story, we hope to touch others.
That's great. I hate to cut you guys off. I really do. And we barely scratched the surface. But thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on a beautiful film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Todd and Jed Wider, Laurie Singer, God knows where I am. I had to double check. I've got a lot of interviews today. Miscall the film. That's all we need. World premiere, right?
Yes, world premiere.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.